Before we begin, if you're enjoying this independent podcast, I'd really appreciate it if you could do a review, like, share and subscribe. And if you'd like to see the video version of this episode, please head to the Patreon. The link is in the show notes and it's a great way for you to show your support.
Making a movie with a psychopath is a little like poking a snake with a stick.
Get on with your bloody work. Tell me what to do.
You know they will hurt you. You just don't know exactly when or how badly.
Get to work. It's part of what I do.
Fuck off. Get to work.
In the late 2000s, Australian filmmaker Ian Walker became entangled with Sam Vaknin while making the documentary I, Psychopath. The goal of the film was to follow Sam as he was assessed by experts all over Europe to become the first known civilian volunteering to undergo rigorous diagnostic procedures and even have a brain scan to determine if he was in fact a psychopath. While Ian was prepared to witness some outbursts, he hadn't expected to be on the receiving end of quite so many rage attacks. The main catalyst was about doubts over his academic qualifications.
I'd grown weary of Sam's off-camera tirades against me. They were now getting more frequent and more vicious. This time, I was determined his behaviour wouldn't go unrecorded.
Shit face. Pick your nose and lick your fingertips. Do something you're good at. You got that?
I don't really want to work.
Got that.
I don't want to work like this.
I want to work like this. That's the only way. That's what I think about you. You're fucking idiot, shit face, everything.
Ian wasn't supposed to be in the film, but recognised the impact on him working with Sam needed to be recorded.
I don't particularly enjoy doing the video diary thing. It's not really my thing. But I do want to remember what I'm feeling at any particular time during this adventure, because part of me is worried that that I'm in some way going to be changed for the worse by this encounter.
His fears were realised, and a decade and a half later, Ian is still haunted by his time with Sam and his wife Lydia, which is why I was keen to talk to him and share details of my own encounter with him and the horrifying facts I'd uncovered in my investigation.
Ian, it's such a pleasure to be talking to you. I've been really looking forward to this. I'm excited because I've watched I, Psychopath multiple times. It's been a great research tool for me. And actually being able to compare some of the information and things that he says and, you know, he then lies about later on. But, you know, me reaching out to you and asking you to do this interview, how did you first feel when you were like, you saw the name Sam Vaknin again?
He hasn't come into my world for a very long time because of I took to heart the advice of Bob Hare, the psychopathy, you know, doyen professor who, you know, created the gold standard checklist that we all know about relating to getting a psychopathy diagnosis. And, you know, he said, you know, the only way to deal with these people once you've been in their orbit is to have zero contact. And I know Dr. Romani in the film, in your film, mirrors that. And that is the best advice if you can. But if you're married to them, if they're in your family, you know, if you're stuck in an office with them or they're your boss, it's not always possible. But I did take that advice. And so, yeah, getting in touch with me was like opening an old wound. I watched the film halfway through. I was cranky with all of you people because you were letting him get away with calling himself a professor and he was the savior of the world. And then there's the big wonderful twist and it's a gotcha moment, and I was very relieved. And I feel great that someone's taken up what I started, you know, nearly 20 years ago and have, you know, helped to sort of nail him to the wall. I feel like he's slippery as. I hope he doesn't wiggle his way out of this net, but I'm very grateful that you made the gotcha movie that I wasn't able to make back then. But even then, there were many, many people online, many women who were talking about allegations like this back in 2005 when I started with him. But I was there to make a science film about getting a psychopathy diagnosis. And, you know, that didn't stop him. He got a high score in my film, a legitimate diagnosis of a psychopath, a very high score. He was a bit shocked at the time, but it didn't stop his business plan. He managed to, you know, wheedle on and find some new people like Richard in the podcast world that's made him an even bigger sensation in the internet, which is a problem.
I have so much to say there, but we'll start with your film in that I agree that you would think that that would potentially sort of destroy a person or be a giant red flag for people like, hey, he is actually this, and look at some of the behaviours during this film because, you know, he has multiple rage attacks. But actually, he manages to sort of pivot that and almost uses it a badge of honour, and the bad stuff, he sort of erases it because he's like, oh, well, that was a hit piece and that bit's not true. He made me say that. So he's kind of used it as a tool, which must be slightly painful, but I hope together with Narcissist Playbook and this podcast, there now is no doubt. There will be no doubt of what he's capable of. Before we delve into some of the points you made there, I want to ask you, just so that the people listening, in case they haven't gone to watch iPsychopath, it is available online, you can go and watch it, I thoroughly recommend it. What was the goal of your film?
So I first met Sam when I was a radio reporter and making a program about corporate psychopaths. It was a new term then. We hadn't heard about it. We didn't know about these people who were amongst us in our offices and could be our bosses. And it was a book by Bob Hare, who I spoke about, called Snakes in Suits. And it got me thinking about that this is a really interesting topic. I made a one-hour radio show. Sam was about 1 minute of that radio show. He was talking about the relationship between narcissism and psychopathy and the sort of, he was talking about the difference between narcissists and psychopaths and the scale that they're on. So they're on the same sliding scale. And he said some strange things to me. He said he thought he might be a psychopath, and that just stuck with me. I thought, I don't think I've ever met anyone who's said that. And what if I made a film about these people? How would I do it? I'm going to have to meet one. I'm going to have to be in the same place as one and experience what that's like. And as stupid and hubristic as that idea was, I thought it was the only way to make a film about these people. And so I circled back to Sam after about 18 months of research and not finding another single person in the world that I thought would have the same credentials. I went back to him and asked him about just that. I took a trip to Macedonia. I stayed over there for about 3 days in the research phase. I had 8 hours of Sam talking about himself for 3 days straight. And, you know, that almost broke me. But I thought this guy is the guy that has at least some self-awareness of his pathology and is game to take up the challenge of me taking him to the psychopathy labs of Europe, getting his head in an MRI machine, doing the gold-plated checklist with various experts, and taking along his wife with him, and getting him a diagnosis, which we did. But in the process, it all went very pear-shaped and took a massive toll on myself, and I ended up in the film. And it wasn't something I intended at the beginning of the film.
And you see you doing the video diary and you actually say, I'm not entirely comfortable with this, but I recognise I need to record how I feel. It was a brilliant idea for a film. And yes, especially the fact that you're getting, you know, psychologist, psychiatrist, the scientific side of a brain scan. You know, it's a legit thing to do. And, you know, this is a wonderful idea for a film. But yeah, the impact on you, when did you start recognizing, uh-oh, I need to look after myself here?
Well, in the middle, it was about day three when he first went for me. The sticking point in our film was my questions that we'd uncovered in our research, that him calling himself Dr. Sam Vaknin was actually a con, and that the PhD that he kept talking about didn't actually exist, and it was bought from a diploma mill. And we knew all that. And the very first time I raised it, about day three, he was very clever, Sam. We only had a two-person crew, myself and the camera person. I was doing sound as well as directing. And as soon as the camera went away in the camera bag for the evening, he would turn on me and just start abusing me, low-level abuse about, you know, what I was doing. Did I know what I was doing? Was I a real filmmaker? And this went on, interestingly, like very sporadically. Like he would choose, he's a master of manipulation and abuse. He's very good at what he does. And that's why there's so many victims that you've uncovered. And over the period we shot together, the project went for about 10 weeks of filming in the first instance. And we had a whole other leg of the film that was supposed to happen in Canada afterwards. But after that thing happened at about day three, I did promise my producer that I took a handy cam, very small camera with me that I would use as a video diary. Even if we didn't use it in the film, it'd be great for notes. And he managed to charm everyone who was in his presence. And my video diary entries at the end of the evening when I'd been abused, I just sounded like the mad person. I sounded like I was losing my shit, and I was. And he came across on our camera every single day we shot with him, with these scientists and everyone else, as a perfectly reasonable, charming guy. And that was his methodology to sort of break me, prevent me somehow from raising the issue about the fake PhD. And we actually, myself and my cameraman, we bailed on the film after the day that I captured his abuse on camera. I had to hide a camera in a gym bag, something I'd never even thought of doing in my entire journalistic career. Never done that kind of stuff. And I was trembling and I was a mess, and I caught him abusing me, which is sort of the finale of the film. Sorry, spoiler alert. And once I knew that I had that evidence and that I could show other people what I'd been talking about in these video diaries, I knew that I had to get out because I was going to have a nervous breakdown, basically.
Sam, I'm not interested in fighting with you about money.
I'm not interested in your shit face.
I'm really not interested.
You're the most narcissistic person I've seen. You're the voice of a croaking frog and you fancy yourself a singer. You're an idiot. So here we are. Do you want to go or not?
I know you're trying to punish me, but I'm not really sure.
Yeah, I'm not trying to punish you. You're so inconsequential. I'm trying to manipulate you into doing the movie that I want you to do.
Well,
okay.
So. Good luck.
And myself and my cameraman, we actually escaped from a hotel in the middle of the night and checked out and went to the airport and called off the rest of the shoot. We were destroyed, you know, and it didn't end there. I got very ill a year after making the film. So it cost me quite substantially. Nothing like the level of harm that he's done to the people that you're talking to in your film. But, you know, it was absolute toxic workplace that I created for myself. And I'd somehow magically thought that I wasn't going to be the victim in this because I had the camera. And he loved the camera, as you know. He's a crazy level malignant narcissist, psychopath. So he loves the camera. And I thought that would be my defense, you know, that he needed my camera there to improve his business plan. You know, even if we proved he was a psychopath. He'd somehow twist that and he'd work on that as the new business plan, you know. Maybe he'd update his book, you know, call it I, Psychopath, and I'd Never See a Cent, you know, something like that. I don't know.
I'm so sorry that you went through that. The subject matters of my work, I often take, you know, it takes a huge toll on me. So I really, really do understand. And at times I've been really unfairly treated as well, despite me giving so much. And, you know, I very much believe everything you're saying there, and you're not exaggerating the impact it had. So I'm really, really sorry. And to hear that you actually had to bail on it, because sometimes if there's something going on in a film, you've got to just almost dig in, lean into it even further. But the fact that for your own safety and sanity, you had to say, I'm going to, you know, cut this project short because I can't do this anymore. That, I think, is a demonstration of how serious it was. It's not just someone giving you, you know, being a bit of a dick. Like, it was abuse and it was messing with your mind.
Yeah, it really was. I wasn't the same person afterwards, and it took me a long time to, I guess, get back my equilibrium. As I say, a year after making the film, I got the worst case of shingles that my doctors had ever seen. I was 3 months off work and very, very ill and in an enormous amount of pain. And all of that was stress related. It took me quite a bit of therapy and a lot of love and care from my family to get me back together. And I've never made a film like that ever again, and nor will I. And it was hubris, and it was kind of stupid to put myself in harm's way and think that somehow I would be immune to his abusive ways. The only thing that I can say is that I'm glad that, you know, I did suffer some pain, but I'm very proud of the film, and I know that it's helped a lot of people understand how these people operate. And I'm very glad that there's another, you know, movie coming out that's going to follow up that and do it in such a spectacular way, and at the same time take down this, you know, heinous sort of charlatan who's been doing very depraved things to very many people for a very long time now.
You mentioned that women had posted comments online, allegations about him, but were they as serious as the ones we now know to be true?
So the details were scarcer. I mean, they weren't saying exactly what was happening to them, but there were many of them, and it was all the same operandi, like the therapy shtick. He had very many groups that he started with about narcissistic abuse, and they were supposed to be survivor groups, and he would be right in the middle of it. And then the fallout from that there was a whole bunch of you know, groups of women mostly who were anti Sam Vakten and trying to take him down. They were very glad of my film, but they were all reaching out for me to take on their stories. And to be very frank with you, and you must have found this, that the great tragedy of the victims of psychopaths and narcissists is that we sound like the crazy people. And when you start talking about this abuse, it's not only shameful, but it actually sounds like you have really lost the plot, and that can't be true. And so because the abuse is so successful, people do lose their perspective. They're not good witnesses to their own abuse, and that's a real problem. And that's why the psychopaths can keep doing what they do, because witnesses either don't come forward, or they, to police officers, they would just sound crazy. And they do sound crazy. And to me, as a being very new to that idea, I just didn't have the resource, and I wasn't commissioned to make that film, and I couldn't go there with these people. And they were all online all over the world. There were different groups everywhere, but it started back then. He's been perpetrating for a very long time now, and that's a great tragedy.
Yeah, it makes me so sad to hear that. You know, we knew that this has been going on for a long time, but just having an extra confirmation of that, because I haven't talked to, you know, victims beyond a certain date, and we are so lucky. One of the victims that we call her Anne, she's thankfully been able to access a lot of therapy, and she really is out the other end, you know, forever scarred, but out the other end. And she's been able to incredibly eloquently explain, you'll understand this, but me even reaching out to some of the victims is causing them further trauma. And I've had to be so careful. And I've not asked, you know, I've not gone in with a request. It's more like, this is me, and I just want you to know what I've done. We've got them on camera, and this is coming out. But there's when you're dealing with highly traumatized people who actually can't go and get therapy to get fixed because their abuser was a therapist, you know, then it's the most wonderful self-sealing crime. And as you say, sometimes because it's so messy, it's so yucky, he makes them feel like they're actually choosing it. They've got tremendous guilt and shame, and all those things. This is what makes it complicated. And he just wants to muddy the waters, which is why I've had to go into such detail. But, you know, your work is utterly critical, and I'm using parts of your film to demonstrate certain things.
The PhD was acquired in a diploma mill. Diploma mill in the United States means a place where you buy your degrees. So it's a diploma mill. I'm not a real PhD.
You're also a doctor, though.
Technically, I am a PhD. I worked 2 years. I presented a thesis. The thesis was reviewed by peers. It is in the Library of Congress, you can see it. But between you and me, that's not the rigorous PhD that people are led to believe when you use the title.
You'd recorded with them 2 years prior, I believe, and then you did the film. And then after you'd escaped, you then went through all your old footage and found that clip that was in your brain somewhere that he admitted to you. Now, he claims you told him to say that. That's how he's explaining it away. But tell me what happened on that day.
The weird thing, I guess this is for victims everywhere, when gaslighting wasn't even a term when I started this film, I didn't understand that term. I wouldn't have known what you were talking about. The way that he gaslit me about this was just putting me off guard because I knew that somewhere in my brain that the guy had actually bragged about the fact that his PhD was bought from a diploma mill. And I thought, why is he absolutely slamming me now for even mentioning it and then asking him some questions about it? Because I needed to get it on in the film. And I couldn't understand why he was so shy about it now. But trawling through those 8 hours of footage was, intense. And then finding that part and him sort of laughing at me was... You know, I guess it was my salvation in a way that I'd found himself hanging himself, and I didn't need to do any more. And we'd investigated where the diploma mill was. It was based in Hawaii, and how much diplomas cost you. And Sam's very lazy, actually. You know, in a whole lot of ways, he would never have completed a PhD, even though he's written a book and. He has written a book, he would have never deigned to go through the scrutiny of a proper PhD with peer review and academics taking apart his work, because he's above all that, of course. You know, he's smarter than the academics and the professors, and it was a real incredible ride watching him meet all these very eminent professors in Germany who were taking stock of his condition and trying to work out whether he was a psychopath or not. He was absolutely hell-bent on impressing them. He brought his books, he'd shake their hand, He'd, you know, I was sort of in the background somewhere, and I was not consequential to this exchange because, you know, I was the stupid filmmaker. So finding that and clinching that was useful to me, and I guess it stitched up the film as a quite a crazy venture, and that the thing that he was arguing about, he'd admitted all along. There's not a lot of logic to a lot of things that psychopaths and narcissists will manipulate you about. They don't really care. They don't care if it's true. They don't care if it's relevant. I was very careful with Sam as I went into the show because I knew that he would use things against me, anything that he knew about me. So I'd never told him about my family life, about my kids, anything about my partner. I was very private. You know, I was very deliberately private that I wasn't giving him any fuel. But the very few things that I did say about myself, he remembered all of them, and he used them against me. There's a really strange moment when I've sung most of my life. I've done some professional singing, and I love singing. It makes me happy. I told him there was some reason why we started talking about him singing in the shower or something, and I've mentioned that I sing. And he called me a terrible singer, you know, and it was like, wow, is that all you got? You know, he berated me for picking my nose. I mean, at one point, that's in the film, and it's like, yeah, Sam, I'm sorry, I picked my nose. I'm a human guy, you know, and it's really, yeah, it's revolting, but I don't know, I've done it. Is that all you got? You know, but eventually the level of you know, he's just started in on my competency as a filmmaker, and I was feeling pretty fragile at that point because I was being incompetent because I didn't have the evidence on film that Sam was doing this very abusive stuff. He managed to do it every time the camera was in the camera bag, and that was crucifying me. And if I'd gone home without the evidence and had no film, I would have completely broken apart. That was my defense, was that little handycam camera and the scene of him, you know, abusing me in a hotel lobby.
And thank goodness that you had that, you know, because that, you know, but also to find that bit of footage where he's admitting the, well, it's not a real PhD. Well, what I've done is I've contacted the education board in America and asked them if they can confirm. Now, you've got to have permission from the person. And so far, we have not been granted permission from Sam. And all he would need to do is send one line of an email saying, yes, you can, whatever, send me the blah, 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 or send it to them. Which I'm sure that some employers will need to do. It's a bit like a reference, I suppose, that they need to check that you've got this. And why, if this was such an issue for him, that he's in his videos, like at the beginning, he's like, I've got this, and like he lists off his credentials every time. Prove it then. Prove it. There's a photograph, but it's not even for psychology. It really is remarkable when you go through his, you know, his story. One of your, actually, I think it was the German...
Neil Bierbaumer.
That's him, sorry. He had done some, he'd gathered collateral information from Sam's family, and watching the film, he kept saying, oh, but I thought your mum was, you had thought you had a really loving relationship.
But I thought that you had a very good relationship with your mother.
Good relationship with my mother? No.
With your mother?
My mother was the physically abusive person. She abused me physically.
I thought that she was the one who was very close to you and you loved her and blah, 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 blah.
Not really, no. I love my father more than my mother.
Oh, really?
So I was picking up on that. His family have maybe said to him that it was a very different background to the horrific abuse he describes. What did you learn of his family background and how it matched up with his story?
We didn't get to check too much of it. We checked into his academic, you know, the credentials, the things that we could check. It's difficult with Israel but I noticed in your film that the story of his background, his childhood abuse, is much more severe now than what he told us at our film. So in the 20 years that the story's got much darker, much more abusive, much more heinous. I think also he's added another 10 points to his IQ. That was my memory. I may have got that wrong, but it's up to 190 now. I think when we spoke, I'm pretty sure it was 180. So, and now he's one of nine in the world who are that smart. So, I think, you know, he doesn't care. I mean, he doesn't really care. He's very inventive. Oh man, he cried for you. That nearly broke me when I watched that part of the film that he cried for you. And he said previously that narcissists would do that. And that's an amazing moment. I almost lost my lunch when I was watching it. I really quite could not believe that this was happening. And then a beautiful gotcha moment very soon after that was wonderful. Sam's a consummate liar, but he also doesn't, you know, he doesn't remember all the lies like all narcissists and psychopaths. They don't keep track of the lies particularly well, and they can be caught out. It's what happens after you call them out that is messes people up, because they know something's true, or something's a lie, and then they're told black is white. So this idea of the upside down world is very important when we're talking about these people. It's an unfair playing space, that you're never going to get justice, you're never going to get contrition. They're going to tell you black is white, and you're going to start believing that you're the person in the wrong, or you're the person going mad, or you're the person who's needs to improve themselves or do something that they tell you to do. And it's difficult to underestimate how much that can change a person's confidence and mess with their, Sam blows this out into almost supernatural terms when he's with Richard in the room at the podcast space, where he's telling people that he can look at them and somehow suss out which ones are the vulnerable ones and which ones aren't. I mean, you can look out in that crowd, and there's some people who are so intent and looking at what he's got to say that you can tell that they're probably a vulnerable person. That's true. But he can't look into your mind, or it's not a supernatural thing. It's actually just that's all that he does every single day. That's his profession: manipulation, trying to find out what your Achilles heel is, and then he's going to hack at your Achilles heel until you're bleeding and you can't walk, and you're not going to know who you are anymore, because he's going to keep that going and chip away at your most vulnerable point. And he'll have a great day doing that. He'll have had a great day. He gets up in the morning, and thinks about, how am I going to manipulate person X today? He'll have a good think about it, and he'll go and do it. That's what happens.
You're absolutely right. And you are correct about the IQ. It's been 180. It's been 185. It is now 190. But then also the whole thing of after a certain, number, then you can't really test. But he makes a great point of, repeatedly saying that he's smarter than Einstein. That's his... and even that is one of the reasons, though, actually, that he ends up, that the, victims believe him. They also had to be... This was more when Mark first had contact with him, when they were, in the raw state. They actually did believe that he almost had supernatural abilities because of that. But actually, he has picked the easiest hack career or role. There's no one else that you would immediately spill your guts to apart from a therapist. It's pretty sick what he's doing, in that he's, anyone that's going to him as a survivor of abuse or someone who's in the midst of abuse or who's recovering from abuse, for him then to just, he does pick off the people who are also empaths. They're emotionally intelligent, they're sympathetic, they're compassionate to him as a tortured soul. I hate the fact that I'm even this work is important to expose him, but I hate the fact that he will probably be listening to this now and he will be getting a hard on over the fact that we're micro analyzing everything that he's done. But I need to do this for the, you know, the greater good, that people, his flying monkeys, his obsessive fans, they need to hear the detail to understand the truth of, you know, what he's done. One of the most interesting stories that he said to you was that he had really messed up one of his little pals as a teenager. And I know that you said you couldn't track this guy down, but do you remember what he said about that? That he like basically tried to turn him into a robot. That was pretty disturbing.
When I was 12 or 13, I hit upon the idea of psychological engineering, a kind of distorted, malevolent, malignant form of therapy.
Sam's test subject was the son of Holocaust survivors.
Were one of the major routes or paths into his soul in order to destabilize him was by using his parents' experiences as Holocaust victims. I exposed him, for instance, to a barrage of swastikas. I used to paint swastikas on his notebook. I conditioned him to regard Hitler as more and more human. One day I planted a stash of Holocaust victim pictures. These are very famous photos of naked men going to the crematoriums.
After several weeks of pushing his buttons, Sam achieved the desired result, a fully programmable human.
He became psychotic and he was hospitalized in a mental institution, I think for 3 months or 6 months or something. He lost a whole year.
Yeah, that was a real moment of understanding how dark his psychology was. And I'm not sure now of the, looking back on it, of the purpose of him telling us that. I think you're right. He does kind of get a hard on for going to the dark places. And he's made that almost a pantomime with those sessions that are in your film with Richard, you know. But knowing then that they're almost self-confessions, or they are self-confessions, that's doubly fucked up, I've got to say. I can't, you know, it's pretty hard to wrap your head around that. It's sounding much more like some kind of Hollywood movie in the future, that one. So, yeah, he's playing some double or triple game, which is, in some ways, it is quite spectacular. And why it's been so difficult for people to unmask him along the way, you know, coupled with the fact that he just chooses the most vulnerable people. But, you know, you're right to say that empathetic people make the best victims for psychopaths. And that's an absolute tragedy, right? Why should, you know, we as good people of goodwill need to change our entire lives and outlook and hope for the world and humanity and our other human kind because of, you know, the 1% of people who behave like Sam, the 1% who are psychopaths, maybe 1 in 5, according to your film, who are narcissists. But you know, that extreme malignant narcissist and edging into psychopathy, they're the ones who won't be, you know, we actually can't change them, and that's a very great pity. But we also should keep in mind that we shouldn't have to change our outlook about the world because of the 1% of bad actors. It is a difficult concept.
I wholeheartedly agree, and I think actually part of their poison is that someone who's been abused can actually end up behaving in ways in the future that they would never have. I mean, not to the extent of their original abuser, but they do, you know, mistreat others. How did you cope? And I know you went and had therapy and things, but how did you cope after your experience with Sam to try and get yourself back?
Well, the tragedy of it, I think, is that I ended up in the realm of a couple of other psychopaths since the encounter with Sam in the workplace. And I think it was because it was almost like the opposite. You know, I knew enough. I had this very personal experience, which was very damaging to me. And I think in some ways I thought that would make me immune to ever having to do that again. But the reality of this situation is if there are 1 in 100 in any given population, 1 in 10 in maybe more dysfunctional populations and some places where we inhabit, like the media, you know, it's perhaps as high as 1 in 10, you are going to come into the realm of these people. And when I did subsequently, I was very poorly armed. I was very, my you know, my radar might have been up, but my logic was down. And so having some of the best, you know, I should have had the best knowledge in the world, but I was still vulnerable to these people, I guess, because I didn't want to let go of my inherent belief in the good of it, good in everybody. You know, I still want to be that person who's empathetic and wants to see the good in people. And I wouldn't let go of that, even though I was being dragged into another situation, which was, you know, much less impactful on me, but similar to Sam. So knowledge only gets you so far. I think you have to clock those red flags really early and question your intuition. You know, I think the reminder, the great thing about your film is the very succinct way that the playbook can be remembered, you know, in sort of 4 words. Don't never forget the first one, you know, the love bombing and the aggressive charm and all of that, because that that's the very first red flag that needs to be acknowledged. Once you're into, you know, into their realm, into their spider web, I think one of the academics in my film describes them as being, you know, yourself as being in a spider web. It's hard to get out. So when you're in the middle of it, that's quite difficult. I wasn't as well equipped as I thought I was, even after my encounter.
I think the hard thing as well in this story is these women weren't love bombed in a romantic setting. They were very vulnerable. You know, there's more than one of them was suicidal at the point where they went to him for help. They really were desperate. And for him then to try and, well, take them in, be the safe person, and then try and shove them off the cliff himself so he could take credit for it. I've read suicide notes written by, you know, someone thankfully who's still with us. But and then what he did was he wrote back a response to her. Actually, that was saying, well, you know, there are reasons to live. He then posted that online. He did a video about it. So taunting her. So to the face of it, it looks like he's saying people shouldn't kill themselves. There's this dreadful problem of suicide. But he said, of course, there are some people, you know, who should. And it's so sick. Did you discuss with him about his desire to kill, although his incapability of doing it with his own hands?
Bob Hare talks about the violent and the non-violent psychopath, and there's no actual difference in their methodology. Only one will use a knife and the other one, you know, might use an email, you know, in the workplace. So and I always thought of him as a, you know, as a weak guy. He's a weakling. He's, you know, you could push him over. He's not scary, actually, as a physically violent person. So I never had that in my head. You know, maybe I should have, but I never did.
Is there anything that you filmed that didn't make it into the film that you wish had?
Oh, that's hard to remember. It's almost 20 years ago. I don't believe so. There are two versions of the film. There's a 75-minute version, which went out to television in France and Germany, and to film festivals. And there's a 60-minute version. So, but the 75-minute, it has more informational sort of bits about it. It's a bit like your film. We have breakout parts where it's kind of educational. So, and we used a lot of kind of archival. So there wasn't too much other action, I think. I mean, one of the things that I'm not sure is in the 60-minute film now is a scene in a lab in Canada where they talk about the fact that psychopaths can tell a vulnerable person. I mean, this is sort of negating something we said before about the supernatural talents, but that psychopaths, violent psychopaths especially, can tell a vulnerable woman by the way that she walks. And that was borne out in the research in this in Canada. And the videos of that are kind of distressing to watch because they're normal people, but if you slow down their gait, it's just this way that it's a way that lions and tigers understand which gazelle is injured and know which one to go for. So there is something quite primal about that predatory nature. There is a predatory nature in the psychopath narcissist, and they hone that skill because that's all they're doing. That's what they do full time. And you know, for Sam just to think he's smarter than everybody else in the room, you know, it could well be true that he has a high IQ, but that's not the thing that's making him win out, you know, over vulnerable people. It is just the fact that that's all he does, and he has zero empathy and zero conscience about doing any of it. And that's the difference between mere mortals and psychopaths. Like, you know, we wouldn't be able to sleep at night if we'd done any of the things that Sam's done to his victims. But he sleeps soundly, not a problem. I mean, the one thing that I was curious about watching your film was what you made of Lydia, his wife, because she's quite a big part of our film. And deep in my heart, I really hoped that our film would make Lydia question her relationship with Sam and that she may leave him. That was actually one of my hubristic hopes for this film. And obviously she did not, and she's there enabling him all the way and booking his air flights and trying to sell his book and up for the adventure and massively in some kind of Stockholm syndrome. It's wild for me to see that, quite disturbing and a bit sad.
I was actually just about to get on to ask you about that because, yes, you did, you had Lydia in it a lot, and Lydia was around for the filming, and they did actually film with her and a friend of Sam's one day, but it didn't make the cut. And that Lydia wasn't really supposed to be in it because obviously it was more about, well, when the film they set out to make, Sam's just one of the experts, and he ended up being a really great expert. And then it was, you know, they'd finished the film before they found all the stuff out, and they were like, okay, do we ditch the film? What do we do? But what I'll say is of Lydia, and this is, I've got a lot of information and evidence from the victims and from Richard, as well as some of the stuff that's been caught on camera. And I met her as well. I think she is complicit, if not culpable. Now, when you did your film, you know, she was talking about she wanted a baby and she didn't really believe in love, so the love that she got from Sam was good enough, and, you know. But I think they have a very kind of sick codependency going on.
But aren't you a victim? You live with a narcissist. By definition, aren't you a victim of narcissistic abuse?
There is difference between you and other narcissists. You were diagnosed with, tested actually, with high IQ.
Mm-hmm.
And so? It's very rare, to find a narcissist who is able to make the difference. And you went deep inside you, you were honest to yourself, you wanted to know what was wrong after your first wife divorced, after you spent some time in jail, after you bankrupt. So you wanted, you were curious to know more about yourself.
I think it's very common for these, you know, predatory characters to have a constant person in their life. A lot of serial killers will be married, you know, or they've got a long-term partner. They have to have the constant person. I think he's utterly incapable of even tying his own shoes. So I think that's definitely a role that, but then she feels useful. So they've got this really weird dynamic going on. But when it comes to the women, she is used in the grooming. She's used in the grooming because when they, I'll give you an example of one of the victims. It took a long time of grooming, of phone call sessions, video sessions of therapy before they met face to face. And Lydia was there as the kind of, you know, the safe, neutral person, because I don't think she would have flown to meet him otherwise. But weirdly, she then was sitting in as the note taker in the sessions, and she was attending dinner and she was always there. But it's almost when it, and it's too complicated to try and explain in this interview with you now, but when it switches to him crossing the line, there's hints from her like, oh, you look after my genius child, but not being clear. And the victim's like, what are you talking? Why would I need to look after him? You know what I mean? But there's knowledge there. Richard believes that, you know, Sam can't get the same supply from Lydia that he used to. And I think there's maybe part of Lydia that's accepting of him doing, you know, these things to these women, because he knows all. I mean, I think she's hugely jealous. That comes out with her rage attacks in front of them as well, although they don't know quite what it's about, because they are way younger than Sam, and they're all very beautiful, all of them, and smart. But she knows ultimately that he is going to destroy them. He's going to try and, you know, he's going to infect them with a sexually transmitted disease and a cancer-causing one, HPV. She knows that he's going to try and get them to kill themselves. She knows that they're going to be absolutely left in tatters, so she absolutely allows it. So I actually think that potentially, I don't think you're wrong in thinking that Lydia was a victim of some sorts back in those days and potentially the Stockholm Syndrome. But what she has evolved into is an accomplice, sadly.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's, I'm sure that's plausible. And, you know, I guess, yeah, maybe my sympathy for her was misplaced, as it should be with Sam, because, you know, she may well have gone to the other side. That's disturbing to hear that. And, you know, I really hope you can find, you know, justice may come.
Mm. Yeah, and that's the challenge. You know, these women, they've gone to police, and you not knowing the. I love that you shared that about how you were concerned that you sounded like the crazy person. You're a professional filmmaker, and you were going to observe him, and your observations were this, this, and this. That was your job. But to think that even you knew that you might be doubted, I think it almost just further validates what these poor victims have gone through to try. And the thing is, they don't even try to explain. They don't even necessarily share with anyone. I know there are some of them that have not told a single person in their life. They've shared it with the other victims and with Richard, but there's people who they will never tell. Some it's for reasons of shame, and some it's actually reasons of personal safety due to cultures, religions, etc., and how, you know, that might be received. The, you know, the violation to their body, they, you know, would still be blamed on them. Lydia, when she, I think she maybe wasn't fully paying attention during my interview, because it took her a little minute before I could hear her starting to interrupt when I'm confronting him. And then obviously at the point where we stand up, she says, I have photographs of these women.
I will show and you my photos
I've got
when
to
I
do,
joined my husband with
and I've
a client.
Got, and I've
he
got
didn't
to,
have any sexual course with them.
Lydia, you're very wrong in what you're saying right now.
And now she took, this is bizarre, she would take photographs of Sam and a patient in the middle of their session. I've seen them. And it's almost to show that, look, she was there observing it. This is all clean and clear. This is all part of him trying to sort of wriggle his way out of being accused of a crime, which is interesting. But then she said he did not have sexual, either she says sexual coercion or sexual relation. And he stops her and says, Lydia, You're quite incorrect, because he knows from me saying, I've seen the photos, I've seen hundreds and hundreds. He knows what I've seen. That, you know, but do you think that she maybe tries to persuade herself that he's not doing those things?
I don't think so, because I thought Lydia, like you, I thought she was very smart. She's very aware. She does fight with him often. I mean, they bickered throughout our whole ordeal. Throughout our whole ordeal for, you know, 10 weeks straight, and we then filmed these very uncomfortable scenes in a restaurant where he would be talking about her in the third person, about how he doesn't supply any of the normal things that a normal boyfriend would, and he'd sort of dissect her in front of us, and very humiliating for her, and then she would, you know, be cross at him about the fact that he didn't listen to her properly, you know, and it was strange to understand that she understood his pathology. I mean, he'd tell her to her face, but she's still kind of believing somehow that he's going to be the good boyfriend. I mean, what she said to us was that she thought Sam was a walk in the park because he didn't hit her. So she'd grown up as a teenager with boyfriends who did physically abuse her and with a father who was very abusive. So that was the backstory we were told. So she was used to that scenario of being, abused from an early age, and not feeling safe. And with Sam, because he didn't actually hit her, she thought that was a walk in the park. And this sort of psychological abuse was not the same. So I think she probably made a very bad underestimate of that, you know.
If you're not abused and victimized, what kind of advice can you give to people who are abused and victimized?
I was abused and victimized by worse narcissists than you are.
Uh-huh.
I was
where?
Already...
Where and where?
From my childhood, I was brought up in a such dysfunctional family by parents who were... One was a psychopathic narcissist, the other was cerebral narcissist.
Mm-hmm. And you developed...
They actually trained me to find my coping strategies. Mm-hmm. So I do have that experience. And I had it before I met you.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I think that all makes sense, that why she'd end up with someone like him being, you know, again, being a victim of abuse. And as your test proved in the film, that she has empathy, you know, even showing in the brain scan, you can't really cheat that her, you know, she was able to tap into her emotions. I think that the brain scan was actually one of the most fascinating parts of the film, actually, but also his annoyance that his graph was more in line with psychiatric patients than the, you know, the CEO psychopaths. I'm sorry, I'm going to dot off again because I meant to ask this earlier. You were talking about how he was around, you know, there's all these incredible scientists and psychologists and psychiatrists in your film, people that, whether he admits it or not, that Sam would really look up to, he would aspire to be them, you know. Did you witness him sort of, being a little bit humble in front of them and actually almost like the little boy wanting the approval from them and him trying to impress them?
Oh, yeah, there were lots of big gestures about giving them his book and them accepting his book as a proper, you know, academic sort of work. He was desperate to be seen as their sort of equal. He was quite obsequious about it. But also I think he thought he deserved this place, you know, to be alongside them, and was kind of thrilled that he was an interesting subject to them, and that he was also curious, because it was hard to work out. A lot of the time for me, it was very difficult to work out whether Sam sometimes fakes bad or fakes good. You know, which is he, what play is happening here? I mean, we're never going to work it out. I'm not, you know, because he's got this advantage over us. He's is working without empathy or without conscience. So, and always there seems to be several plays in action. And some of them are quite venal and boring, you know. Some of them are just, he explains it as, you know, he's just after his daily dose of narcissistic supply. So he is like an emotional vampire, he's sucking it all up, and he'll move on to the next person who can give it to him.
He describes it, I think, as like, you know, it's a supermarket, like, I'll take from here, I'll take from here, I'll take from here.
I regard life as a giant supermarket, and
that you take what it can.
I stroll among the shelves and whatever comes to mind. It's totally itinerant, totally peripatetic, totally unplanned, totally impulsive, totally. That is psychopathic.
That is psychopathic, definitely. Yes.
Something, sorry, I meant to ask this earlier. This is with relating to his credentials and his diploma. And you have Belinda, who, you know, very politely just asks him, sorry, I just want to check this on your website. And then he has an absolute rage attack over this.
So it was a bit of a stupid exchange. Where's the university? Why you couldn't click on the link? What link? I'm sure there's no link whatsoever. I don't know what she's talking. Why couldn't click on the link? Where can I see your PhD?
But what was so interesting was what she said afterwards was, he is using this as a badge, like, he, you know, his narcissism, etc. But if you take this badge of narcissism away, what are you left with? Did you feel like he was wearing it as a badge?
Yeah, I thought that was an amazing insight, actually. Belinda was a great, person of great insight and skill, I think, to weasel that out of him, being very polite, and he lost the plot. I think the weird thing is that there is some truth in Sam's moment of breakdown in your film, where he sort of says, you know, he's actually nothing. It's kind of true when you strip away this facade of the narcissist expert, the poacher turned gamekeeper, this whole shtick. And if you take away the con and that mask, then there really is a pathetic creature there, but also, you know, someone who's very angry and very venal, and who's secretive, as you found out. But it is kind of pathetic, and he's truthful when he says that psychopaths can't experience love. They don't understand. They're never going to do that full joy. They're also terrible. That's why they make terrible, terrible parents, because they can never do unconditional love. That's just not going to happen. They actually end up in competition with babies, you know, that because babies suck up all the energy in a normal human room, because they should. They're babies and they need to be tended to. But a psychopath will see that as competition to attention. So they make terrible, terrible, terrible parents. And I'm very glad that Lydia didn't have a baby, and maybe we helped that cause somewhat in our film. But Sam, and so you get to the point where you think, wow, I should really feel sorry for Sam. But our sympathy is misguided and misplaced, because he doesn't give a shit about what you think about him. And also it doesn't help you prevent yourself from falling victim to him. It makes you more vulnerable. So, you know, sympathy for the psychopath is actually a misplaced thing, and that's also hard to come to terms with, I think. It sort of messes with your sense of morality, or sense of justice, and sense of there's got to be hope for everyone. But actually, the truth of it is there's little hope for these people to ever be not hurting people. There's hope that they get older and mellow. That's about the extent of it. But the fact that they'll never recover from their disorder, and they actually won't be able to feel those things that we all feel and that we tend to believe makes us human. And that's sad, but don't be sad for Sam, because it's a waste of time.
totally agree with you there. If there was any feeling, if I had a sort of magical wand and I could give him the ability to feel something, I'd want him to feel the utter, utter shame and guilt and all those things. I would want to bury him in the weight of it all, because what he has done, I mean, we don't even know. It really is the tip of the iceberg of the ones we know of. What would you view to be the correct type of justice that Sam deserves?
I think he needs to be called to account for all of his behaviour over many decades. I mean, the guy should be in jail for so many things, and I mean, even on a very base level of being a fraud for so many years, this whole shtick of being Dr. Sam is completely fraudulent. You know, it's on the front of his book. That's a fraud right there. But to be preying on vulnerable people and posing as a therapist when you're actually a sadist is despicable. And the way that you damage people is kind of eternal, you know. So you're ruining those people's lives for the entirety of their lives. And so, yeah, I really don't know. You know, maybe we need to take it back to medieval times, you know. Bob Hare, psychopathy doyen, would mention things like the Eskimos used to find out about people in their midst, in their tribe, who behaved like this, who were psychopaths. And one day on the ice floe, they'd just get an elbow in the ribs and they'd be out of people's hair and away. And I'm not an advocate for corporal punishment, but other places and times have dealt with these characters in extreme ways, because they're very destructive to our community and cause immense damage. He should go to jail for a very long time. I hope this makes his life kind of unbearable, that the knowledge and the build after this film hopefully can make curtail his behaviours. That would be the best thing.
And at the very least, what we're hoping for is to shut him down online so he can't post another thing. His YouTube, I've got texts when Richard got his YouTube taken down for a period, and he said that he was going to leave the realm of psychology and go off to be his whatever he was in the world of finance again, and advising governments, you know. But he said that losing his YouTube for a period of time, you know, but I hope that we can shut down every social media channel he has so he stops earning from them as well. His earnings, I don't know what they would be, but what it is it's actually just an entire, it's just him hunting. That's it. He's just using it. If it's helping some people by telling about narcissists, great. You know, that he doesn't care about that. He is just using it for hunting. So if we can shut the access off for him to reach women, that would be a big thing, I think, for us to be able to achieve that at the absolute least. But yeah, I'd love for him to be back in jail. He claimed, and I think he told you this as well, when he was in jail, he stopped displaying all his narcissistic tendencies, because you can't do that in jail, he said. Did he say that to you? He said it to Mark.
I don't recall that. I know that he hated the jail bit, and he couldn't wait to get out of Israel. He thought there were, you know, very important people in Israel out to get him, to perhaps kill him, because of the people who'd invested in the bank fraud that he committed. No, I don't recall how. Yeah, it wouldn't go down well, I'm sure. You know, his sort of Sam's kind of personality in jail would be very problematic for his own physical health, I would have thought.
As we were wrapping up, Ian had a further thought on one of the most disturbing stories Sam had told him.
Do you think that what you did was wrong?
Well, yes, I think that what I did was wrong, simply because wrong is well defined in the Oxford English Dictionary. So I can't give you a counterfactual answer. As a matter of fact, it was wrong. Do I feel that it was wrong? In other words, do I feel guilt or remorse or anything? No, no, no whatsoever.
The story of basically torturing his childhood friend and turning him into a robot, maybe that's the true story. You know, maybe that's the start of it. Because that really was a wildly disturbing story to think about, you know, and someone young. And I guess, like I said before, I think I discounted it thinking he's faking bad, you know what I mean, at the time. But hearing your stories now, it perhaps is a clue that it was a true story. I still can't understand really why he would tell us, but he, you know, he loves bragging like that, doesn't he? And maybe all the brags are kind of more true than we ever thought. It seems like that's the case. It's been really amazing finding this out. So I think, you know, all power to you and your team.
As we've witnessed so many times in the series, Sam does do wrong to others. He is a predator and abuser. And whether he's directly admitting it or weaving it into a lecture or interview, he has been confessing his crimes for more than 20 years. I'm glad that Ian, who ended up being another one of his victims, has been vindicated in his beliefs that Sam is a psychopath. The Storyteller Narcissist Playbook is written, produced and edited by me, Isla Traquair, and is the fourth in the Storyteller series. You can see videos, evidence, analysis and more on my Patreon. The link is in the show notes and is a great way for you to show your support for this independent production. Another way to show your support for free is to like, review, share and subscribe. A few clicks makes a huge difference and lets people find this important story. If you've been affected by narcissistic abuse, there are links for support in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening.